Chris Carson, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun listening to you over the years. Before we got started, I was like, this kind of sounds weird, but we've been listening to you for a long time. So it's really cool to have you here. We've been looking forward to it. Dave and I, I would not say liturgy experts by any means.
But I would say that about my. I would.
You would
I,
say that about
I feel
yourself.
Like, yeah.
But we're always very interested in what some technicalities and like want to make sure as we're teaching our children, you know, how how to be reverent at Mass, what to be doing, what's happening, and as little kids do sometimes, they'll ask you a question. You're like, that is a good question. You know, and so yeah. It's always good to talk about this, especially because I know that there's going to be other guys out there that are listening that are trying to raise their kids and trying to catechize them and form them with Mass being the center, the source and summit of our faith, you know, the Eucharist is, and that the Mass forms us as a whole to do everything else. And that everything else is formed so that way we can go back to Mass. We just had Brandon Sheard on, and he's a...
Let's just call everyone...
Doctor.
Doctor. Hey, yeah. For this episode,
everybody's doctor.
Will be
Dr.
referred
Adam,
to as...
Dr.
Yes.
Dave.
You know
oh,
what?
That sounds
Gosh,
great.
Doesn't that sound
great,
amazing?
Great. But
I'm just going to change my X handle to just Dr. Dave.
There's some people who've done that and got away with it for a while.
I mean, what are they going to do? It's like, I identify... as a doctor,
but Brandon is butcher by trade, and he made this beautiful connection in one of our episodes that we just recently had with him. He said, like, you know, the end of the pig or whatever is to feed us so that we can be nourished to go to Mass.
Yeah, and about all the, you know, what he called the art of cooking. Is, you know, the point of eating is so you can get back to Mass. You know, there's more to it than that. But yeah.
So I'm really excited to have you on. Welcome to Tulsa. Is this your
Thanks,
first time
Adam.
To Tulsa?
I've been to Tulsa many times,
okay.
Actually. Yeah.
You used to teach, right?
Yeah, in the Deacon Formation program.
Yeah.
I was here earlier this year. So I love Tulsa. I've been here many times and always look forward to coming back. So thanks for the invite. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
And talk some liturgy.
So for our listeners who don't know, tell us just a little bit about yourself, you know,
sure.
Family, job.
Yeah, you bet. So I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin, or close to it. I live on a farm where we raise pigs, actually.
Nice.
And I should say my wife and kids do. I don't do too much of that.
Yeah, what pigs you got?
See, exactly. I said I didn't do this. I don't know the names. They're pink pigs. I don't know what breed they
They're
are.
They're delicious. That's
They're
what they
delicious.
are.
Are they little or big?
They are, they're on their way to getting big.
Okay.
So probably when the weather turns and fall comes. And
so not like not a cooney, not none of these like
Berkshire.
Little. Berkshire. You're talking like a big 300-400-pound pig.
Yeah.
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 All right.
Yeah.
That's where it's at.
So I live on a farm in Wisconsin, and I've been married for 27 years, have 8 kids from ages 9 to 24. I work in the Diocese of La Crosse in the liturgy office and have worked there for 27 years. I've had the same wife, the same job, and the same house for 27 years. So I'm pretty happy about that. So I work in the liturgy office. I also teach liturgy I taught for about 20 years at the Liturgical Institute in Mundelein, and this summer helped to start a MA program in liturgical studies at Christendom College in Front Royal. So did that. And then there's an apostolate called Adoremus, which is for 30 years has been in the liturgical field. So those are the main things I do. So run a liturgy office and teach about liturgy.
Talk about being consistent. Yeah, you know, like same job, same wife, same house, 27 years. That's consistent, right?
Yeah,
there.
I know. I like it.
Okay, so let's dive in. So there are different ways in which you can teach your kids about the Mass, specifically depending on what age they are, right? You know, so how I go about teaching my 2, 4, 6-year-olds is going to be much different than how you can probably still teach your older children as well. What do you think for a young dad who has young children, what's the best thing that they can do to help them, to catechize them in some way, shape, or form that, hey, I know this may be a struggle for you? you know, or this maybe. I don't know about you, but like most of the time when I go to mass with my little kids, it feels more like a physical workout than a than a spiritual one, because you're just juggling your kids, making sure the kneeler's not falling, you know, making sure the books aren't collapsing, making sure that they're not sticking their tongue out at the people behind you in the pew. And I mean, you're just constantly just moving. What is your advice?
Go with it. I think that's not a bad thing. That in fact, I was talking to a friend yesterday. They were talking. He has to work a lot on Sundays, and his wife takes their kids to the churches with the best cry rooms and the most friendly cry rooms. And I was saying, you don't. She should not have to take her kids to cry rooms. You know, kids baptized little kids belong in the nave of the church as much as, you know, great grandparents do. Now I get it. Sometimes it can be a bit. It can. You need to leave.
Yes, but there are some people, and I'm not pointing fingers at anyone specifically, but who they like. This is their. You know, everybody has their pew. There are some people who their pew is in. Like they show up, they start in the cry room. That's like their experience of mass. And I wish there was a like a. I would like to invite those people, like you're saying. Mm. Into the nave, like come and join us. Yeah. Your kids, like they're not that bad. Come sit next to us.
You'll feel better.
No one will even know you have kids.
Yeah, but I think what's behind all of this is that what the Catholic Mass is, in a way that other non-Christian worship is it's bodily, and it uses the senses, and it's got smells and bells, and you drop books and you drop kneelers and. Now, I'm not a Cheerios guy in the pew myself.
No.
So I wouldn't go that. But, you know, if you were angels, which we're not, you know, then all this body stuff that you think might be distracting or something like that would be out of place. But we're not. We're souls and bodies. And so I think it should be a bit of a physical workout. Now, hopefully, eventually, not to the point of distraction, but... Yeah, we pray with our bodies, and part of the discipline of praying at the Mass especially is disciplining your body and noticing things and sensing things and paying attention to things. And so I'd say that maybe one of the first things that a dad or a mom, you know, could do to help help kids is help them to pay attention and notice things. And hopefully the Mass that you're going to has a lot of stuff to notice. Not because the priests and the ministers are going, you know, crazy with creativity and look at me and that type of stuff, but the Mass by its nature is the sacramental thing that is, you might call it's a work of art. That's the way the Church talks about the Mass now. Maybe you heard this expression, ars celebrandi. It's an art of celebrating. And, you know, if somebody told you they were an artist, maybe your next logical question would be, oh yeah, well, what's your medium? Mm-hmm. Or do you paint? Do you dance? Do you sculptor? Do you, you know, what is it that you do? And the Mass is a work of art, has all of this stuff to pay attention to and to notice. It's got music, it's got oratory, it's got vestments, it's got sculpture, it's got woodworking, it's got, did I say vestments already? You know, mm-hmm. It's got choreography, not necessarily in terms of dancing, but, you know, the gestures that are made. And so it's designed for human beings to notice all sorts of stuff. So I think maybe that would be the first thing is helping kids to pay attention to something that's worth paying attention to. And so that's why, as I say, you know, priests and ministers, you know, they're trying to reveal this great masterpiece so that we can see it. That's what I do for starters.
So, you know, here, and I think the experience here is somewhat universal across the country. If you go to the Latin Mass parish, it's full of young people. You know, you have all these young families, and there's just something about the tradition, I think, of the Latin Mass that is attractive to them. What is it that, and I don't like the notion of there being competition between the ordinary form and the extraordinary form. I think that's a bad attitude. Needs to be rooted out. But you know, I have to admit, I've been to many liturgies where it's like, I get why people don't. You know, like this church isn't full because it just wasn't. It was. I felt like so much lacking in just the way it was celebrated. What is it? What do you? If you could say, here's one thing that might be good. Like, hey. This is something that's allowable in the ordinary form that would be a way of kind of tapping into some of these beautiful traditions that exist in the liturgy, what would be some suggestions you would have for just regular parishes?
Yeah, well, I think that, and I agree with your opinion on that. But it's not your opinion; incidentally, I mean, what's the expression? The mens ecclesia. So the church sees this too. That was Pope Benedict's intention as well, not this competition. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, it was to be a mutual enrichment. So the post-conciliar mass could sort of get back to its roots, if you want to put it that way, because there's this the expression that the Pope used. There's this hermeneutic of continuity, that it's an organic growth. It's not an artificial creation. And so to get back to that mentality will help the post-conciliar liturgy. So what would I suggest? I mean, is that when 10 o'clock mass on Sunday morning comes around, everybody is or should agree to be on the same page, to play by the same book. So I think it would start by going back to the Roman Missal that we have as a norm, but then understanding it in this proper hermeneutic, that it wasn't an invention of 1969, 1970. And this is a point that Pope Benedict would make. If you were on the very progressive side, you saw it as a new convention. Hey, isn't this great? We got rid of all that old stuff. We got something brand new here. But it's the same error as those on the far traditional side, that, oh, this is a clean break with what came before. Isn't that awful? Well, they're making the same hermeneutical mistake. It's not. And so to see the current books in light of the tradition out of which it grew is the right way to see it, the right way to celebrate it, the right way to pray it. And so what that means for some of the concrete ritual elements, would be, and this is what, I think what you would experience if you went to a preconciliar mass is perhaps some chant. Now, it wasn't always this way. We shouldn't think in 1950, it was just, that was by the book. It wasn't. There was a lot of hymnody going on. There were problems in 1952, 1950 as well. But to see some of these traditional elements that are still by the book, in the book, whether it's the church's musical tradition, the use of incense, a type of presidential style that isn't about the priest's personality. And this is not, I say that not blaming priests. I mean, Father might not want it to be about his personality, but we do, right? We want him to be funny and look at us and all the rest. So there's a type of transcendence that, maybe this is probably an overgeneralization. There's a type of otherworldliness and transcendence that you see in the pre-conciliar form. There's a type of accessibility that you see in the post-conciliar form. And I think what Pope Benedict wanted to do was to kind of bring some of these together so that people today could participate in a transcendent reality, which is God. So,
do you think part of some of the issues with the average Catholic in the pews is that there has been a bad attempt of catechesis, but it just has not gone well, that they don't even know why we're here, like what the purpose of the liturgy is, what are we doing? Like, do you think that that's a, because when I look at it,
next question.
I see,
is it just, for you or is it for God?
Right. And some of the like the choices and preferences that the average Catholic ends up having and has developed in the liturgy, I see as like, I don't have a problem with, you like ad orientem, you like versus populum. It's like, okay, they're both allowed. But when you talk to people about that and you engage in those conversations, or they, I think, are a good conversation to have, I realize that I don't even think you know what the liturgy is. What it's doing. So will you tell us?
What are we doing?
When we go to mass, what are we doing?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. Let's say you polled 100 Catholics as they came out of the door and says, why are we here? What's the purpose of this? How many would respond, we're here to praise, glorify, and adore the Father through Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit so that we can become saints? Out of those 100 people, how many people would give you that answer? Because that's the right answer.
Yeah, right. Right.
And I think, unfortunately, it would be pretty low. You said this a couple of times in your question about liking ad orientem or liking versus populum. The most, I think, unfortunately, the most common liturgical litmus or principle that's guiding decisions is very often I like it or I don't like it. And, you know, that's who we are. I mean, we like things, we don't like things, and that's okay. But when it comes to the liturgy doesn't care what you like or how you feel.
Right.
And that's not to say that God doesn't care what you like or what you feel, but you're supposed to find satisfaction for your individual temperaments and circumstances and all of the rest in a personal and devotional life. You pray however you want there. But when you come to the liturgy, there's sort of this more of an objective. It's like the liturgy is kind of a foundation. It's a skeleton. There's a structure to it, an objective. It's an objective thing that sort of forms us. If all you had was the liturgy, if that's the only type of prayer you had, you would be sort of an immature and malformed Christian. You do need something else. And this is this personal life and family prayer life and devotional life that kind of gives heart and emotion. It gives outlet for emotion and expression. And you like this music? Great. Knock yourself out. You want to pray while jumping up and down or lying flat? Great. You do whatever you want. And those two things have to come together. And I'm going to ramble on enough that I'm not going to remember what your original question is.
Well, you know, go ahead. Keep going.
You know what? I think the situation, real or imagined, you can believe what you want about it, is that 100 years ago, our great-great-grandparents were doing devotional things during the liturgy. Well, so to correct that, we got rid of the devotional things, so it was just the liturgy. And then the liturgy had to bear the weight of everybody's likes and preferences and wants and desires, but it's not meant to do that. So, so in terms of the catechesis, I think, I mean, I've often thought that maybe the most significant thing we could do to help the church's liturgical life is to instill devotional life. Because if people could see that that's where they can pray however they want, I mean, within limits, then the liturgy can be the liturgy, and it's not trying to do all of these other things, and it's not battles of, oh, well, St. Mary's likes it that way, and so that's what they do, or the 4:30 over at St. Patrick's, you know, that pastor there likes this, and I like that, and, you know, it's not meant to be like that. Now, incidentally, too, this is not a problem in 2025. Robana Gardini wrote this famous book called The Spirit of the Liturgy in 1918, and he's talking about some of the very same things. So, yeah, there's a lot of liturgical, human, catechetical stuff that still needs to go on, but there's a lot that needs to happen.
I was just thinking about God in the Old Testament, and he's giving the instructions to Moses, you know, like, this is how you will build the tabernacle. And I was just picturing him going like, unless you'd rather have it some other way. It's like, yeah, I think you were going to die if you did. Like, if you accidentally walk in that tent, you're not coming out, you know? Like,
yeah, it's true. And have you ever heard this line? This is from St. Augustine. I'm not sitting around reading the corpus of St. Augustine. So it must be in the Office of Readings or something like that. But it's similar to this, David. It says, in order for human beings to praise God rightly, God first praised himself and then gave us an example of how we could worship him, which just sounds great. It's like, here's God saying, all right, listen up. You want to worship me? Let me demonstrate. Let me worship myself. Okay, you see what I'm doing here? It's based on the Logos, based on the Word. It's animated by the Great Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Okay, now you try it and see how it goes. So, yeah.
Well, we do that a lot as parents as well, right? It's like, oh, okay, yeah. How to honor your father and mother? Okay, look, here's how I talk to my dad and my mom, you know, and or here's how I demand respect from me, you know, in our house. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you do things like say, yes, sir. You tell them what to say.
He's like, okay, now you do it. You know,
so true.
What do you, I have four boys, one girl and one on the way, but the four boys, two of them are old enough to be altar servers. I'm curious what you're like. What does the church say the role of the altar server is, and what is the end goal of the altar server?
Yeah, I suppose in some ways, Adam, the end goal of the altar server is the end goal of the pig. is to sanctify us unto the glory of God. So why should your kid be an altar server? Again, not because he likes it. Hopefully he does. Not because it's cool, but it is. It's all to, you know, Jimmy, you're serving at the altar so that you can become a saint. And you have this sort of front row privileged seat that I don't, your father doesn't, you know, but you do, to be really at the heart of the Redeemer in a certain sense, right? The altar is Calvary, where the heart of Jesus is opened up for us right there, right next to you. And so to be an altar server, I think, you know, it's all a means to sanctification. And again, I say this, so I was about to say, how many altar servers know that? Well, my kids serve at the altar too. I mean, it makes me think, does my kid know that? Every time I talk about something, I'm just sort of, what's the word? I'm incriminating myself. I'm really good at, you know, telling other people stuff. But I'll do this. I'll promise this to you guys. When I go back home, I'm going to tell my son Lars that, you know why you're up there, kid, is... not so that the older church leaders will love you and think you're cute, which they do, right. But you're up there so that you can become more like Jesus, you know? So anyway, yeah, altar serving is a great thing and a great privilege.
I love that way of phrasing it. I don't think I would have thought about that, you know, I go to Mass to be more like Jesus, right? But obviously, the altar servers are still going, you know, like, of course, that's why they're here. What I see, which, you know, I see young boys up there, and it's like, and I really like to see a good, sturdy young lad up at the altar serving, right? There's just something right about it. What I wish is that these young boys would stick with it, right? So often they hit like 12. And it seems like they self-discern, you know, like almost as if this is for just little kids, right? And I would just love to see us, the church in America, I can't really speak to the culture of, you know, the church outside of the U.S., but maintain more of a...
How would we do that?
What do we do?
Hierarchy, like with servers to help that? What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I suppose maybe part of it's catechetical, is that, you know this line from the Council from Gaudium et Spes that John Paul talked about all the time, that Jesus came not only to reveal God to man, but man how to be a man. And that I think that, you know, to explain to our sons that it's manly, well, it's certainly humanizing, but in its own way. And we all maybe have I'm no master of the spiritual life. You know, when it comes to our relationship with God, there's a feminine aspect about us. Mm-hmm. But it's manly to serve at the altar because you are becoming like the ultimate man. You are becoming like, you know, people are going to look at you and say, Ecce homo, that kid right there. Behold that man, because he's so much like Jesus. So maybe part of it's that is that, you know, you're never too young to grow up and be a man. I mean, so man up, put on that cassock and surplus and get out there and light those candles. I don't know.
It's interesting to hear, like, your sons after they serve and you ask them, you know, what are your thoughts? You know, what did you experience? Yeah, just I try to ask open-ended questions just to see what they're going to say, you know.
That's great.
And sometimes it's really silly things, but then sometimes you're like, oh, you were paying attention here. For instance... recently, my son said, like, well, when the priest goes from the ambo, which he didn't call the ambo, but when he goes to the ambo from where he sits, he bows not to the altar, or not to the tabernacle, but to the altar. Why does he turn his back to the tabernacle? And I was like, yeah, that's a good question. You know,
go ask your mother.
Yeah. So how would you answer that question?
Yeah, well, certainly during Mass, the altar is Christ. The altar is Christ. And if, you know, just briefly, like...
What do you mean by that?
I mean, the altar is Jesus.
Well, the Eucharist is Jesus.
Yes. When it comes to the liturgy, everything is a manifestation of Jesus Christ. Now, in some ways more than another. So, for example, again, to go to Sacrosanctum Concilium, Christ is present where two or three are gathered. Christ is present in the person and action of the minister. Christ is present in the Word because he is the Word. But Christ is present in a par excellentium, in a most excellent way, in the Blessed Sacrament. But all of these things are manifestations of Christ. And the altar is one of these particularly privileged loci of Christ. So if you've ever had a chance to go to the dedication of an altar.
Yeah, it's a long mass.
Yeah. So you remember about it? Yes. Yeah, that's true enough. It is a long mass.
Before you go.
But the order of events is really cool. In the beginning, the altar is naked. There's nothing there, right? There's no cloths on it. There's no candles on it. There's no flowers around it. And when the bishop, who's the minister of Christian initiation, when the bishop walks in, he ignores it. He blows right past it. He does not bow to it. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't kiss it. And as the mass progresses, one of the first things he does is he sprinkles it with holy water. He anoints it with sacred chrism. He vests it in an alb. There's a solemn lighting, and then the altar, this is a line from St. John Chrysostom, it says the altar receives its first Holy Communion. And so through this baptism and confirmation and the vesting in the alb, receive the light of Christ to be kept burning brightly until, you know, God returns, it receives these initiation sacraments. So now, with Lars, my kid, to say, so now it's an image of Jesus. I mean, you don't kiss your kitchen table. But you kiss the altar because it's Christ. So why does the priest and the ministers bow to the altar? Because it's Christ. Not in the same way that the Blessed Sacrament is, but not in a fictitious, empty, imaginary way either. There's some reality there. And so that's why he does that. And if you get your kids to, you know, if we go back to the beginning, what should you do with your kids? Get them to pay attention, you know, because oh, there's Jesus in the altar. There's Jesus in, you know, in Father Barry. That's when he talks like Jesus now. Yeah. You know, after Mass, he talks like Father Barry. You know, but now he's talking like Jesus and acting like Jesus. And the words are Jesus' words. And, you know, if you can get your kids to see Jesus sort of looking at you, searching for you, around, behind, beneath, every moment at the Mass, then you're like, oh, wow, okay, now I'm getting it. Now I'm getting it. And that's where I think, you know, for me, and my kids are older than yours, but, you know, if you get your kid leaving your house knowing how to recognize Jesus at the celebration of the Mass all over the place, what more can you do? What more can you do?
So what do the rubrics say here? You are just the person to ask this question.
We'll see.
I've been
thinking
about this.
Yeah, why do you set him up like that? Like, what if he doesn't know? That's so rude.
If he doesn't know, nobody knows.
Oh, boy.
And I'm just going to have to, like, make something up.
Don't do that.
So, you know, when you come into Mass, you genuflect to the altar. But then, yeah, once the liturgy begins,
genuflect to the Blessed Sacrament.
Thank you. The tabernacle. Yeah. Thank you. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
But then once the liturgy begins, then you reverence the altar, like we've been saying. So if you have to get out with a kid to take him to the bathroom in the middle of Mass, should you genuflect, or is it actually more proper
to bow
to the altar instead of genuflecting to the tabernacle?
That's a great question. I don't know. Okay. Well, I'll say this, that once you don an alb and you're a minister of the church and the celebration of the liturgy, she's more precise about what to do and how to do it and when to do it. For us laity who may be in the nave, there are more instructions for us now in the post-conciliar rubrics than there were in the pre-conciliar, but not to the degree for ministers. So I would say, first of all, no book anywhere answers that question.
Okay.
So I think you have a little bit of legitimate leeway. It might be reasonable to say, well, if this is what the ministers are doing, I'm going to do the same thing. But we can do different things. You know, we don't have to wear an alb to Mass like Father does,
right.
The deacon does. So, it's okay.
Okay, so there isn't there's freedom to do either one.
Yeah, I'd say there is.
What's more fitting?
That's what. Yeah.
What would I do?
What's more fitting? Like,
how much of a fuss is the kid making?
Yeah.
that's a good gotta go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good question. Yeah. I like that.
That's a really good point.
I wouldn't, my scruples should probably not, I don't know.
I like, you know.
Yeah, you're scrupulous kid.
It's like, if you don't have, if it's not like a struggle, let's get the scruples going. Okay. If you struggle with scrupulosity, don't listen to this, yeah. You know, but.
I would say as long as, again, I'm older than you guys, as long as your body can, as long as my body can do it, I'll genuflect.
Yeah. Okay.
But if I got my hands full with a screaming kid or something, I wouldn't lose any sleep over bowing.
Sure.
Or,
sure.
It, who knows? Maybe
or
just making
bolting.
A U-turn and getting out. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Because if they're like screaming and you're stopping to genuflect, everyone else is like, really? Jesus forgot
I was in
that you like
prayer and you're still holding on. Yeah. Okay. So, when your kids get older, the way in which you catechize looks different. My oldest kid is 12, so I'm just now getting into. There's like a bell curve almost. It seems like with kids where they don't understand Mass, and then they actually start really loving Mass, and they're understanding what's going on, and then they kind of start hitting these teenage years, and the bell curve you're going down, and they're like. Kind of get the whatever phase or kind of disengaged phase or whatever. How do you combat that? Like, what do you do there?
Don't give them an option.
Well,
on the one hand, I guess I would say, you know, to pray well at Mass, yeah, there is a certain type of formation that as you're saying, Adam, has to take place. But the thing about it is, you know, you don't have to work for a parish or for a diocese or have a degree or anything like that. You have to pay attention. You have to have senses. Anybody who has senses and can pay attention can encounter Christ in the incense, in the bells, in the music, in the language, and all of these things that make up the liturgy. So that's one of the beauties about, you know, how God has arranged the system of worship is, you know, anybody can do this. And you know this, right? You know, the bells ring at the Sanctus and your 3-year-old all of a sudden goes, huh?
Right.
You know,
yeah,
they notice something
that.
So if you can help them to notice, I think is the first thing. What else? But that's not to say, you know, your liturgical formation should only go as far as, okay, I'm paying attention. There's other things that can help us to go deeper. I give like one example and that's like Lectio Divina. And I give this, as an example this way, because, and I'd be lying if I said the Karstens family is doing Lectio Divina all the time, you know, it's just what we do. It's not. Now, it should be, and, you know, we make our resolutions at Advent and Lent that, okay, this time we're going to, you know, we try and we sputter, and sometimes we do better or worse. But we were doing Lectio Divina one year, and this was some time ago, but I had kids, you know, different ages, right, from 12 to 10 to 8 and all the way down. And every one of them can join in. And it's this particular one, it was some reading during Lent, and it was this story about where some Greeks come to to Philip, and they say, we want to see Jesus. So Jesus brings them and says, hey, Jesus, these Greeks are here, and they want to say hi. And Jesus says, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and die, it remains but a single grain. But you know, it is now the hour for the Son of Man to be lifted up on the cross. And, I don't know about you guys. I'm like, okay.
Do you want me to tell them?
They did, we just want to say hi. Not quite sure what you're talking about now.
Philip turns back to us. He said no.
So, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But out of the mouth of like a 6-year-old says, well, I think what that means is that when Jesus is on the cross, anybody can see him. And I'm like, oh, unless there's somebody standing in your way, he went on to say that. But the point is that, you know, that... How do you form, you know, different ages or your kids throughout their growth? And I suppose is once you can teach them some fundamentals, then you set them up to go deeper. you can't force them to go deeper. You could do it in a family setting. That's kind of forcing them. Okay, it's time for Lectio Divina. Oh, do I have to? But, you know, I think you can demonstrate to them that you can always go deeper and have more profound encounters with God. And what does that do for you? It gives you peace and joy and happiness and beauty, all the things that the world cannot supply. So I don't know. Maybe that seems too pie in the sky, but I think it, I think that's how it works.
If they have, some of mine are readers, like what would you suggest to sometimes I find that I, as the teacher of the family, like it's best for me to just hand them the book because they'll actually
right.
Listen.
So it doesn't. They're not, it's coming from dad. You. Yeah, you know, like dad.
Yeah. What books would you recommend for them?
Oh, just it's kind of a formation in liturgical prayers. They're growing up.
You mean for like a 12-year
for
old?
For like a 12. Yeah, yeah. 12, 13, 14, 15, you know, as before high school.
Did you have a rubrical question you could ask, David?
The Bible.
Yeah, the Bible, and then the first part of the second part of the Summa.
You're not ready? Because you're not ready for the second part of
the second part. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is a great question. That is a great question. I like Ted Shree's A Biblical Walk Through the Mass. Mm-hmm. Because again, it helps you to understand what's going on at Mass. And I suppose a 10 or 12 or 14 year old, or for that matter, a 60, 62 or 64 year old, is probably doing a lot of things that they don't know why. And if you can see some of, especially the biblical rationale for, especially some of these typologies, I think are very appealing to people. That, oh, he says that because Moses said that? That's really cool. I never knew that. Because I think a lot of people, especially adolescents, you know, think, you know, I don't understand this. It seems pointless to me. But if you can connect some dots, then I think that's good. So, yeah, I think Edward Shree's, is it A Biblical Walk Through the Mass?
I think so.
It is. Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
It's very good. I don't know. I have a little book called A Devotional Journey into the Mass that is based very much on these same types of things, is helping to get beneath the surface of why we do different things. And
what was it called? What was the book called?
A Devotional Journey into the Mass. Thank you.
But, yeah.
So, but yeah, same types of things. If you can demonstrate how to pray and what it means when you pray, then, you know, then when they're 18 and they leave, it makes some sense to them. And they're equipped to really flourish and to go deeper into deeper waters and the rest. So I wish I had a list of more and better.
Well,
books.
Well, I was trying to give you that one for your book. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember exactly how old I was. I was in my mid-20s. I went to Catholic high school, and I remember.
But he was a big sinner. He still is, actually. There's no reason to put past tense.
It's objectively true that I am taller than most people. So, I think I was reading Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist by Brant Petrie. That could have been it. Anyway, I read about the fourth cup, or this idea. I think Scott Hahn talks about it as well, about, you know, that what's Jesus doing there at the Last Supper, and, you know, the sort of the scandal, what would have been scandalous, how he alters the, you know, mm-hmm. the Last Supper rite and drinking that last cup of wine on the cross. And it just blew my mind about, like, that's happening in the, like, this is it. This is what we're doing. And, like, this is the moment that we're being made present to. And I remember feeling cheated. I remember, like, feeling like I had been ripped off a little bit, that nobody had ever told me this. Mm-hmm. You know, and it just, and I, it's just so beautiful when you realize, because I had heard people say things. I think we got to be careful what we say to kids. Like Father John Grant, our friend, he has this story about when he was a kid, someone's telling him, like, when we go to heaven, it's going to be like being at Mass. And he just started crying. Because he's like, no!
We do have to be careful what we tell kids.
Like, whoever said that to him meant good things by it. But, you know, as a kid, he's like, that's the worst. but, you know, just that idea of, like, the beauty of their connection to the cross. Because people say, oh, we're made present at the cross. And I remember thinking, like, whatever, you know. But I'm just thinking about, you know, Luke, your son, or 12. I think a 12-year-old boy is totally ready to just have, like, that like the imaginative side of the liturgy just, like, opened up to them.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, if I go back to that story about the 6-year-old, about, you know, Jesus and the Greeks, I mean, out of the mouth of babes, I do think that, you know, we're called not to be childish, but childlike. And I do think, you know, we're all cynical of things by now. But when you're 12, hopefully, you know, you're not yet. And there's naivete is not the word either, but there's an openness and a docility to true things of the supernatural world that I think there is a capacity probably that our kids have that we've lost. I mean, think of catechesis of the Good Shepherd, right? Mm-hmm. And how that works with kids. And I've often thought, and I'm no expert in that, wouldn't it be great if there'd be a CGS for, like, adults? But I don't think there is. And I don't think there can be, because we're for better or worse, probably worse, you know, we're past that. And so, yeah, and I think like you guys are saying, there's a right way and a wrong way to explain things about the Mass. But I think, you know, kids can maybe see and hear and smell and taste and touch things with an openness of heart that we don't have. So who knows? Maybe there is, maybe they're better positioned to participate in the Mass than we give them credit for.
Okay, so Chris, I want to ask you about the Eucharistic revival that, you know, has been taking place around the world or in the country. I don't know if you have your, you know, thumb to the pulse of how that has been going. How would you say it went or is going as a, like, a movement that the bishops are trying to get going?
Yeah, I would say it, in my opinion and from my perspective, it succeeded beyond what I ever thought possible.
Praise
God.
So
I think especially these last year in particular, the main pilgrimage routes, Eucharistic Congress was just mind-blowingly successful. Like a lot of things, though, I thought it kind of ended last summer, and it wasn't supposed to, was it?
Right.
It's supposed to end at Pentecost this year, but it seems like, for all intents and purposes, it really did sort of end. But I think it succeeded in maybe answering some desires that many Catholics have for something substantial, something beautiful, something life-changing. So yeah, I think it was a very positive experience for Catholics, for the Church, for the sacraments, for the liturgy. It's a whole, but hopefully there's more to come.
So with this idea of a revival, you know, we've been doing some things here in our parish. You know, for instance, one thing we do is once a month we will have just a brief moment of adoration at the end of Mass.
And benediction.
And benediction, which is beautiful. You know, and I think there's probably around the country parishes doing things, you know, sort of, you know, as like, hey, let's do something for the revival. And it's going to be over at Pentecost, you know, what should we do? You know, because obviously I agree with you. I think the whole notion of this Eucharistic revival is 100% needed. You know, if we're not about the Eucharist, then I'm leaving. This is not the place for me if we're not about the Eucharist. So
it's like the Flannery O'Connor quote, right? If the Eucharist is just as simple, to hell with it.
Yeah.
I think that's what she said.
Totally. So what should we do, like, just practically as parishes? Should we just keep going with some of these things we've been doing? Or, like, you know what? There's a question in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it.
Yeah.
Well, there's an answer in what I'm about to say.
It's more of a sentiment with a question mark at the end.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. What should be done? I think the things that succeeded, we should continue to do. So for example, I work in a Dawson Liturgy office. You know, I do not have enough Eucharistic canopies. Okay, I have parishes calling me all, hey, do you know where I can get a canopy for Corpus Christi?
That's what I'm talking about.
You know, 20 years ago, I never got that phone call. And well, in fact, even think about this. I told you I've been in this office 27 years. 25 years ago, the questions that people were asking on a regular basis is, where's the tabernacle? Can't we move it back into the sanctuary? Should I hold hands at the Our Father?
No.
Things like that.
I can answer that question. No.
Can we use glass chalices? These were really common questions 25 years ago. Wow. I haven't heard those questions in 10 years. You know, today the questions are ad orientem, altar rails, singing antiphons at mass. And I'm not commenting on it. I'm just saying this is how things have changed. But I think it indicates an openness to more traditional elements, right? And this is what we talked about the early part of the show, is that this missal just didn't plop out of the sky, you know, 60 years ago. It was cultivated over the course of centuries. So there's that. But where to go next for the Eucharistic revival? You know, they liturgists used to say the principle is right, but their application was wrong. Pope Benedict said this in Sacramentum Caritatis, something like the greatest act of Eucharistic adoration is the celebration of the Mass. And so when they said this 50 years ago, what they were driving at is, well, get the tabernacle out of here then. You know, that wasn't the right conclusion, but the instinct is something right. I think that the Eucharistic revival isn't simply or even primarily about perhaps adoration or holy hours or processions. It's the font and the source of that is the celebration of the Eucharist and the Mass. Now, these aren't competing Jesuses or something.
Right.
Like, they're supplementary and complementary. But maybe I'm showing my liturgist cards here. So I would want to see the celebration of the Eucharist get better and better and better. Not better according to what I like or you like or don't like or whatever. What does a better celebration of the Mass look like? It means it's one that's has complete fidelity to the ritual books, that appreciates the traditions out of which it came. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's transcendent. At the same time, drawing people into its mystery. So there's priests and ministers they're responsible for that. But even if your priest and your deacon, your lectors are doing this as humanly perfectly as possible, you know, those of us out in the nave need to know how to, we might hate it. Okay. But again, liturgy doesn't care what I like or dislike. I need to be taught how to pray, how to appreciate the things that I'm encountering, the signs and symbols and the Mass. And so what I'm about is, is helping celebrations of the liturgy, especially the Mass, be more according to the mind of the Church. And that's where my efforts are in any case, while at the same time praying, adoring, worshiping outside of Mass, but really making that 10 a.m. Mass on Sunday like the most glorious hour of your entire week.
Mm. You're singing my song.
What's one thing or maybe one or two things that's in the rubrics or that's supposed to be in the Mass that the ordinary Catholic would be like, I did not know that was like, maybe I don't do that. Like, I don't, maybe I'm not doing the right thing at Mass. You know, I'm always wanting, like, I'm a nerd. I went through and read all the germ and like, cause like, I want to know exactly what am I supposed to be doing here? Cause what I do, my kids are going to want, like, look at me and I want to be doing the right things at Mass. What's one thing that you commonly see as you travel around that you would think people would be kind of shocked to know that's actually part of the Mass?
Yeah. Well, I would say first, I think singing proper antiphons more regularly at Mass than singing hymns, because the tradition, the Roman Rite.
You don't like having Martin Luther at the Mass?
Well,
Well, can you also make a distinction on what the hymns and antiphons are?
Yeah, so there are options at the Mass for the opening, for the offertory, and for the communion to sing basically psalms. Okay? And there's a number of options. The last one is to sing a hymn, but the first four are to sing psalms, either in Latin or in English, something like that. And they're called propers. They're kind of tied into the Mass. I mean, when people leave Mass, I mean, one of the biggest things that people talk about is the music. How good is the music? So I think maybe singing some of those. And also, people probably don't know this. Well, I could test you guys. I mean, what's the most important part to sing at Mass?
The consecration.
Sanctus? Yeah.
No. It's the dialogues. Anything to which the people can respond with in song is number one category.
Okay.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
That's category one stuff to sing. But most parishes, that's like, you know, you got some weirdo visiting priest who's like really into music, and he sings this stuff, and you're like, man, I can't wait till he's gone next week. We get back to being normal. But no, those are, so I think that would make for a sung Mass, a beautiful Mass, that I think that would go a long way. But again, if you just started doing that, most people in the assembly are like, what is this guy up to?
Yeah.
You know, he's just doing what he likes. No, no, he's actually doing what the book says and what the tradition has been for centuries.
Do you know I think that's fascinating. Do you know the origin behind that? You know, I'm just thinking about the people, the bishops, you know, they're at Vatican II putting together this liturgy. Because that's not a part of the preconciliar Mass. Is it? I mean, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
The priest would be doing singing.
As I understand it, you had the recited or low Mass or red Mass, or you had the solemn Mass or sung Mass. And in the recited Mass, you had to say everything. And in the sung Mass, you had to sing everything. But there was never really any middle ground. Okay? So even though the solemn Mass, the sung Mass, was the normative Mass, it was rarely done. And so even though it was not the norm, what most people experienced was the red Mass. Now, one of the things you could do at a red Mass is after the proper antiphons were sung, for example, you could sing hymns and things like that. But so that we came out of a red Mass tradition. And so that's why I explained, no, they were not doing that prior to the Mass, even though that was the norm. Well, we're still not doing that, but that would be one thing, Adam, that
if that just started to happen,
that people would think, you know, where is this coming from? Well, it's in the books and now that tradition. Yeah, I think a manner of presidency, you know, that the priest has. Again, we're in a very sort of casual culture now, and probably if the priest, you know, is not saying good morning or looking at me and things like that, would come across as rigid and cold and things like that. But he's not supposed to. So that would maybe be some of the things. I mean, there's others as well. Incense is kind of a normal part of the Mass. And I think it's making a comeback. But for a while, it was sort of the ecclesial secondhand smoke. You just did not do it.
I mean, like my preference, my like amount of, I know we're not talking about preferences, but it's like, I want to be struggling to breathe.
To breathe, yeah.
Like I want people being slain in the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah.
From like lack of oxygen.
Oh, I know.
No, it's like, is he okay? I think he's okay.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean, but anyway, we can say more about that.
So, you know, when the liturgy has options, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, that, you know, okay, sometimes for whatever the thing is, it'll say, all right, you can do this, this, or this, kind of like what you're talking about with the hymns versus the psalms. You know, so you can do this, this, or this, or if you just really want to, we will allow you to do it this way. It feels like, so often we have made the permanent always choice of like the thing that was kind of allowed if you like needed to, and that just kind of became the norm for the Mass in so many.
Yeah, it's true.
So many of those things, you know, whether it's which Eucharistic prayer is being said at Mass, or even the use of the Vigil Mass, you know, it's not. I don't know. I don't feel like. I don't think it was supposed to be like this is your Mass you go to. It's like sort of allowed. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, the history of the Vigil Mass
get him
is
in trouble, dude.
Yeah, well, it's not. I mean, it's the documents said, right? I mean, that were given.
No, I don't know. The history of the introduction of the Vigil Mass is not clear, at least in my mind.
Okay.
It's kind of a canonical exception, and part of it, it became possible when the communion fast was relaxed. Right? It used to be you couldn't receive communion unless you fasted from midnight before. Well, you're not going to go to Vigil Mass at 5 o'clock if you've had to fast until then. So when that became relaxed, it became an option. And I think part of it was meant to be a response to sort of modern or postmodern culture and how people work and things like that. To my mind, in any case, that's a very confusing and complicated question.
Okay.
Yeah, but to your point about all the various options, yeah, you know, there were very few options in the preconciliar liturgy. Unity, really coming out of the Council of Trent, and a sort of ultramontanism with the First Vatican Council and a centrality, that was kind of the theme. And what the Second Vatican Council wanted to do, you can say for good or for ill, it was to give local bishops and, where possible, local pastors the options to celebrate a liturgy in virtue of the people that they're caring for in Tulsa versus Papua New Guinea versus in Rome, right? Because they're different needs, they're different assemblies and the rest. And that's a good principle, isn't it?
Sure, I think so.
Yeah, but many priests will talk about almost like optionitis now. There's so many options that go through an OCIA book. I mean, there's like option A through L for the prayer. At a certain point, you just want, all right, just tell me what to say, right, and I'll be happy with that. I think what happens in the liturgy, and probably in humanity too, you got a bunch of options. You take the easy one and you get used to it. You get in your routine and voila, you're off.
Yeah.
Doing the same sort of oftentimes low bar, least common denominator type of, maybe that's too disparaging a way to put it. But and so I think we have kind of lost sight of what a normative liturgical celebration might look like, to the point where it seems, wow, I didn't know we still did that.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that the Council Fathers said that the lay faithful should be able to sing or say in Latin those parts that respond to them. I thought they got rid of it. You know, so we're in some cases we're really far from the norm that it's pretty foreign.
And I'm good with that as long as it's always ordered towards, obviously, the true, the good, the beautiful, and always with the idea of ascend, like having the lady ascend, then normal laity, their souls ascending upward, right? So like if we have to have a low bar here for now, like so that you can get, you know, your eyes can go up and ascend and look up to the Lord metaphorically, like I'm good with that. But yeah, like we should always be trying to grow in the spiritual life, because the moments you're not growing, you're not growing. You know what I mean? There's no stagnation in the spiritual life.
You've probably heard this. I didn't hear this till recently. It was certainly meet the people where they're at, like a father to his kids, and then lead the people where they need to go.
Right. So
this is what Jesus did for us, right? He condescended to become one of us. Mm-hmm. It's not just God became man, end of story. It was God became man so that man could become God. Mm-hmm. And so God meets us where we're at and takes us where we need to go, which is to the heights.
So Chris, when I think about a parish that is like really thriving, I think about one that's like oriented towards its mission. It's mission driven. It's, you know, creating a people that is desiring to evangelize. Okay. Evangelization is really a required element of the Christian life. How important is the liturgy in the life of evangelization?
Yeah. John Paul would talk about this, is that, you know, when with new evangelization, it begins with this encounter, with a fresh encounter, with a new encounter with Christ. And he talks about all these gospel events where people have this encounter with Jesus. He feeds them, he comforts them, he heals them, he restores them to, you know, whatever. And so many of them end with him saying, now don't go tell anybody about this, okay?
Yeah.
And they never listen. They can't help themselves. And so what he would say, John Paul, is that, I mean, not the only place certainly, but the most privileged place to have a substantial encounter with Jesus Christ is the liturgy, the Mass. And so if we... But it's sort of like, you know, when you tell your kids, all right, so Bishop Condrillo's coming, okay, so make sure you look him in the eye when you meet him. I want a good firm handshake when you shake his hand. Make sure you're standing up straight and you say, good to meet you, Your Excellency, or something like that. You have to teach somebody how to meet somebody. Mm-hmm. And so we have to teach our kids, our parishioners, how do you come face to face with Jesus Christ in the Mass? Because if you can, you won't be able to help yourself but to be impelled out at the end and say, you've got, like the woman at the well, you've got to come meet this guy. He might be God for all I know. Come meet Jesus. So I think the place of liturgy in mission is certainly not the only place, but a real, I think, core place, because, you know, if you can have that life-changing encounter, which is what Mass is meant to be, then, you know, think about when Moses was in face-to-face with God for 40 days, and he just soaked up the divine radiance. And then when he went back into the camp of the Israelites, he was a different man, and people noticed it. Yeah. Now, they were freaked out by it, but...
Can you put a veil over your
head? Yeah, yeah. So let me interrupt you here.
I can't even look at you right now, bro.
But, you know, you might know this line, St. Carlo Acutis, right? Says that when you go into the sun, you become tan. When you go in front of the Eucharist, you become saints. And then that's what he does. And then he goes out to the world and say, look at that kid. And he's attractive. He's drawing people to him, not to him, but God in him or through him back to God. So yeah. That's what evangelization is. That's what mission is.
So, you know, I think that we often get an attitude in parishes about, you know, we have this collection, we get this money, you know, this has been given to us, we need to use this wisely. And sometimes I wonder if there's a notion of like, hey, let's, you know, try to use this, you know, we got to feed the hungry, these good things to do. But maybe like, well, let's try to save money, you know, in some of these areas so that we can, you know, send more out. Do you think that's the wrong attitude, or should we be saying, no, actually, part of what we do here is we spend a lot of money
on our
liturgy. Yeah, I mean, like, how much...
Man, you didn't know you were getting all sorts of types of questions coming out of...
Well, there's this element of stewardship that needs to take place, right? But, you know, look, the thing is, beautiful vestments are not cheap.
Right.
If you, like, want more candles, like, all of these things, they cost money, and they're... I just worry, like, or I wonder, is there a notion, do you think, about that says, no, don't, we should save money here so we can buy more food for our food pantry? Ought we to do that?
I suppose it's, you know, the virtues in the mean. I think you can go to both extremes.
Sure.
And say that, you know, we don't need anything beautiful, you know, for the Mass, and everything should go out. But then you can have the other extreme that, you know, it's, and this is a lot of these liturgical movement figures. I've mentioned Gardini before. And Pius XII will talk about this, I think, in Mystici Corporis Christi, or no, Mediator Dei. That, you know, a lot of people looked at the liturgical movement in the 20th century. These are just aesthetes who are just into nice things. You know, they just want to recapture like old stuff and bring that back. And they're all saying, no, that's not at all what we're after. If we want some of these things restored, it's all for the purpose of sanctifying people and restoring Christendom. That's what the end game is. And so I think to your question, David, is you can err on both sides.
Sure.
I suppose it goes like this, is, you know, the Mass is for your sanctity and God's glorification. And the next part is you going to get somebody else and helping him to be sanctified to glorify it. So there's a real connection. I'll talk about this in the presentation tonight, you know, that mass means mission or missive. You know, they're the same word. It means to go out. We were talking about instructions for opening hymn and offertory hymn and communion hymn. There is not a single you read the general instruction, Adam. What does it say about directions for the closing hymn?
There's not
nothing.
One.
Nothing. Yeah. Mass ends with...
Because it's over.
Mass is over, yeah.
That's it. But we want to put a little bow on it, right? So we can get on and watch, you know, NFL or whatever it might be. No, it's supposed to be sort of this incomplete sort of... Not quite over yet. It's a mission to go out and to, you know, help somebody else be sanctified next time. So there's certainly a relationship. It's not one or the other. It's both really connected. So.
Chris, it's been great to have you on the show. I appreciate you coming on. And it's a quick flight in and out of Tulsa, and you made time for us. So I'm very, very grateful. Where can people find your book? Where can people find out what you're doing, what you're about, and stay in touch?
Yeah, well, you could move to the Diocese of La Crosse if you wanted to, and that's a great place to live. Through Adoremus is, again, we're in our 31st year, and we're really about helping priests and ministers celebrate the liturgy beautifully according to the mind of the church and helping people to pray it as well. So Adoremus is doing a lot of things. We have a bi-monthly bulletin, a monthly electronic newsletter. We have interviews with authors. You can listen to articles online. We're working on some good other projects that will help in especially parish level liturgical formation. The books are, you know, A Devotional Journey into the Mass, A Devotional Journey into the Easter Mystery are from Sophia Press. There's a book on solemnities from Ascension Press. One on principles of sacred liturgy from Liturgy Training Publications. So those are some of them there. But anyway.
Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Cheers.